This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Usher, 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 Usher.
Michael, oh my God, you're on Broadway. Broadway.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
That's Michael R. Jackson, a 41-year-old composer and playwright. His musical A Strange Loop won the Pulitzer Prize in 2020, and it begins its run on Broadway this month. A Strange Loop is about a man named Usher, who also happens to work as an usher. He's a black queer writer who is writing a musical about a black queer writer who is writing about a black queer writer. Usher sings about the terror of the blank page and the terrors of dating and sex, and all in terms that are quite frank, which we'll hear in some of the clips played in this interview, just so you're aware. Staff writer Hilton Auld's talk with Michael R. Jackson about A Strange Loop.
One of the things that is so extraordinary about this show is that we have never seen anything remotely like it on stage or in a book or in a movie. There's just been nothing like it, Michael. And I wanted to ask you, for the folks out there, what was the genesis of you writing a play about a gay musical theater playwright working as an usher, talking about his life while trying to write a musical about AIDS, and among other things?
Well, it started as a monologue initially that I wrote in between graduating from undergrad playwriting and going to grad school for musical theater writing. At the time, I was about 22, 23 years old, and I was just very uncertain of my place in the world and where I would go with a BFA degree.
Where had you studied?
I studied at NYU in the dramatic writing program. Mm. And I had moved. My friend Kisha had been living in this little old lady's house in Jamaica, Queens, and she got a live-in nanny job in Tribeca. So then I moved into the little old lady's house in Jamaica, Queens, all the way at the last stop on the E train and the F train. And then you take a bus from the train to get to her house. And I just lived upstairs in this bungalow-style house. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I don't know what to do. And, like, my student loans were coming due, and my parents wanted to know what I was going to do with my life. And America was about to go to war with Iraq. And I was just, like, just this little black gay boy just sitting, you know, upstairs in this old lady's house. So I started writing this monologue that was about, you know, a young black gay man walking around, you know, New York wondering why life was so terrible. And just reflecting on lots of whatever was going on in the world at that time.
Yes.
I went to grad school about 9 months later. So I decided to try my hand finally at writing my own song. And the song that came out of that was the song Memory Song, which would end up being the penultimate song in A Strange Loop.
5'4" high school gym, sneaking a cupcake.
These are my memories. These are my memories. Shooting hoops. Well, how long was the process between that monologue and you reaching the stage at Playwrights Horizon?
Oh, it was about 16 years.
Wow.
One lone black gay boy I knew who chose to turn his back on the Lord.
You shared with me off radio, as it were, your very early love of people like Tori Amos. And Linda Ronstadt and all those girls and all those girls who can sing, as they say, but also writing songs that matter to you a great deal. Do you think that they had a great or at least a galvanizing influence on your writing, music, and lyrics?
Yeah. So I will say first that, like, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, Motown, and, like, my parents, you know, are like children of, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so that music, like Motown sound, Philadelphia sound, all of that stuff was, and gospel music, all of that was very much a part of my world as a kid and growing up. So that was there. But then within that, my cousin Zanita had gone to Interlochen and then she got kicked out. But what she brought back was the album Under the Pink and Little Earthquakes by Tori Amos, who, for whatever reason, she thought I might enjoy it. And so she gave me her copies of those albums. And so one night when I was about 15, I, like, decided to listen to Under the Pink. And I turn off the lights, put on my headphones, press play on the Discman, and then the first thing I hear is, "Tears on the sleeve of a man. Don't wanna be a boy today." And I was like, oh, it's on. Like, it was something about that just, like, reached into my soul. I was just sort of coming out at that time. I was in my most angst-ridden place I could have been as a teenager. And this, like, red-haired, piano-playing white woman just was reading me for filth.
Yes.
Even though it was her life. It wasn't really about me. But there was something about the way she approached her feelings and her thoughts, the way she ordered her thoughts, the vulnerability, the sexuality, the talking about religion. Because then the next song goes, "God, sometimes you just don't come through." And I was like, you know, black boy raised up in a Baptist church, you know, hearing that, like, being gay is bad and you're going to go to hell and AIDS and all this stuff. And, like, that music, it gave me, like, a real outlet to, like, really start questioning a lot of what I was raised with and under and around and, like, you know, feeling like it was okay to be a weirdo within, you know, my category, my identity category.
I think that one of the things that is so extraordinary about this piece is your freedom in it.
Yes.
You want to give voice to something that I had never seen, and I'm ancient, on stage in terms of not only the artistic process for the protagonist, but also parallel to his disappointment or experiences in the gay world, ideas about sexuality and love. Can you talk to me a bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm from Detroit, and I actually came of age in the mid to late 90s as a gay teenager, but, like, at a time when the world was slowly starting to sort of move toward acceptance for white gay people. But, like, but meanwhile, in my little world, there was a whole bunch of black gay boys around me who were all, like, it was like, I always call it the black gay teenage storyline. That it was like this little, like, melodrama happening underneath, you know, behind the scenes. And, like, and I, as I was coming out into that, still felt like kind of an outsider, even within, like, my own category. But then when I moved to New York, it was like things shifted into what in the show is called Gayville. Mm-hmm. Like Exile in Gayville. Of like the white gaze and like trying to orient myself to that.
Usher enters the sexual marketplace.
Looking into hum.
You can do this. You can do this.
In terms of like being a black gay who didn't fit in with like these white gays for all kinds of physical reasons or racial reasons, whatever, but also competing with other black gays for the white attention, but not measuring up to the black gays competing for the white attention either, and the alienation that came from that at that time as somebody who hadn't found his any sort of confidence or self-love, you know, within his body. Plus, just the baggage of having been raised with a lot of homophobia and shame and all of that, it's all was like swirling in a loop, one might say. And so in the show itself, I just wanted to tackle that and like what it feels like to be in the middle of that.
6'2", 179 pounds, muscular, single, packing in the front and in the back, able to take care of all your anal needs. Just say hi.
Looking into hum.
Undetectable pause bottom, taking loads in the toilet at Lucky Burger on 52nd Street, just steps away from industry and therapy. Come park it right here, gents. Don't be scared. Just say hi.
Looking into hum.
Laid back, nice guy here. No agenda, no drama. Just checking things out. Maybe looking for a gym buddy. Lol. Top if it goes there. Just say hi.
Hi. Hi.
Too black.
Too black.
Too black.
You're too small.
You're too small.
You're too small.
And when was the last time you got your information with Beyonce?
I would go to the LGBT center to these like really humiliating speed dating events and like not get picked by anyone. And again, it was like a predominantly white thing. And I couldn't figure out like this, like, it was all very confusing.
Too fat and black to live at all. So why don't you just ravage me with your white gay dance savagery?
I mean, one of the things that is profound about the piece, of course, is the way in which you really talk about the white male gay gays and how your protagonist is used to fit uneasily certain kinds of fantasies about black queerness. And I wondered, was that experience something that you found as dispiriting as your protagonist, or was it something that you felt that you knew that politically was, there were, the roots were kind of rotten?
You mean for Inwood Daddy?
Yes.
So the Inwood Daddy scene in A Strange Loop is one where Usher, the protagonist, goes to meet an older white man who he connected with on, you know, an app like Grindr or Scruff or something like that. And he goes to his apartment in Inwood in northern Manhattan. And he ends up in a very racist sexual encounter with this man, where this man assumes that Usher is into being degraded racially, and he like says a lot of disturbing and racist things to him during sex that Usher does not refute.
Right. He doesn't challenge and then, it.
Right. So that scene and that in my relationship to it is a really interesting one, because it's very tricky. That white man in that scene is using Usher, the protagonist, in a particular way, but Usher, the protagonist, willingly participates.
Yes,
in that.
Yes,
and like, and that's part of what the song that he sings after that encounter called "Boundaries" is about.
Why did I do that? What did that do for me? What a performance. Where are my boundaries?
it's for me, it's too easy to say,
yes,
oh, these white men are like preying on black boys. I mean, there's a truth in that for sure. But there's also another piece of it that, like, somebody comes from a place of desperation, of shame, of low self-esteem, that you will, when you come from that place, you will often subjugate yourself to another person,
yes,
thinking that that will get you validation, love, acceptance, whatever. And then when it doesn't, you know, you have to sit with yourself and, like, what your part in that was. And what their part was in it, for sure.
For
but,
sure.
Like, what your part was in it. And that's certainly something that I went through in my life, you know, and many times in these kinds of situations. They weren't necessarily as extreme as this, but they felt, they sometimes felt like they were.
Now on my hands and knees, why play submissive? What are my boundaries?
Do you think that the piece, that A Strange Loop helped you evolve as a person?
And to let go
of certain of the scenarios that are in the piece?
I do, because the thing about it is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I started writing the original monologue as a sort of building a sort of life raft for myself to understand myself. And it wasn't until I got to a place of understanding that in my life, I was caught up in a loop of self-hatred, that I could see what Usher's problem was, and therefore what the structure of the piece was that would lead him out of that and into, like, a better place. What that meant was, in my own life, that it allowed me to get to, like, higher ground.
I should stop overthinking and do the thing that's tough. Unleash my hungry lion, 'cause no.
It didn't mean that all my problems went away, but it meant that I could understand my humanity and my selfhood as being something that was not inherently flawed in some way, that I couldn't escape and therefore had to keep trying to fix.
And may the journey never end, Michael, right?
Yeah, you know, the yellow brick road doesn't have to end here. Life is fabulous for ladies after 40.
Yeah. Michael, thank you. You are a treasure.
Thank you, Hilton. I always love talking to you.
Yes, and I'll see you very soon.
Maybe I don't need changing. Maybe I should regroup. 'Cause change is just an illusion. And I is just an illusion. If thoughts are just an illusion.
Michael R. Jackson talking with staff writer Hilton Auls. Jackson's musical A Strange Loop is in previews on Broadway, and it opens on April 26th. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Strange Loop.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jack Antonoff just won a Grammy for Producer of the Year, recognition of his work on albums by Taylor Swift, St. Vincent, and more, not to mention his own music with the band Bleachers. I spoke with Jack Antonoff last summer, and the Bleachers album, Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night, had just come out. It's the music you really want from a Jersey guy, music you can blast while driving fast down the turnpike, heavy on the horns and on the big emotions. But as big and joyous as the music is, Antonoff also describes the album as a heavy one for him in personal terms. And I asked him what was going on while he was writing it.
I spent so much time writing about grief and loss. My sister died when I was 18. It's a very singular experience. It's a tragic experience in my life. And it took me years to realize the space around it, which I think is an interesting trapdoor with trauma. I noticed it with friends, especially if you're young, or, you know, I was 18 as a formative time. It becomes the rug in which everything gets swept under. Everything is, well, your sister died, your sister died, your sister died, or this trauma, this tragedy. And I think this thing happens where you become like sort of a personal genius in one language of grief, but like an infant in everything else. All those years that my friends were examining themselves and their tendencies and their parents, I was just sort of like, anything dark with me is from this trauma. And that's not true. And that's actually a really dangerous place.
To be crude, you mean it was an excuse or a catch-all in some way?
Yeah, it is. And it's this album got really heavy for me because for the first time, I knew I wasn't going to write another batch of songs about grief because it's something that lives you forever, but I felt like I'd explored it. So then I started exploring all these other things. And this is where, you know,
what did you feel you were exploring in this album?
All the things I missed because I kicked everything under the rug of grief.
And what are we including there?
I mean, not to be too broad, but why I'm this way, my tendencies, the systems in my family that don't work, the ones that do. I came to Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night because what I started to realize is that there's an evil eye. It might be Jewish, it might be cultural, might be my specific family. There's a darkness that hangs pretty intensely, and I want more out of my life, and I want to break into the next phase of my life, and that's weird. So I kept seeing this image of a doorway, and there's all this hope and joy on the other side, right? There's all this frustration and anxiety of, like, sometimes it's literal, like, you're holding this bag, and it's like, you can't take it all through. It doesn't work. I do not get through this door with all this. I know that. You know, I wrote songs called, like, How Dare You Want More.
Well, I was just going to ask you about this. Tell me about that song.
That song came from letting go of some anger towards my parents, because I found some things out, and when I started to like really look at their relationship and our home life, and, you know, nothing horrible, but just stuff in which I'm like, God, you put this crap on me, and I got to live with it. It's the reason why I have all this trouble. And you know, after some time, I started to say, no, these are human characters who want more, you know, and I'm not talking about money. I'm not talking about a bigger house, obviously. I'm talking about more. You know, more out of your life and the things you really desire. So much darkness wrapped up in that for people. There's no amount of sort of work success that ever makes one feel better about these, like, big rubs in their personal life. They're just separate. They're just separate.
You worked with Bruce Springsteen on one of these songs, and he has talked about, I mean, late in his career, he's talked about battling with depression for year after year and comes and goes, but he didn't really confront it until middle age.
Is that useful to you, to talk to other musicians who are older than you, not just about the music, but about the experience of this seeming ideal creative life, successful creative life, and the realities of when you come home from the performance?
Remarkably important to me. I would call it like soul saving. Bruce and Patty are incredibly, I've touched on a little bit here and there, but incredibly important figures in my life because, you know, there's a lot of people who have great careers. And there's a lot of people who have really, you know, kind of like great, robustly vulnerable personal lives. There are very few people who can hold both. And if you're out there trying to have both, which I am, which, you know, there's a certain shame that even comes in saying that. How dare you want more? Man, you better find some people to believe in.
Yeah, we both have to fess up. We grew up in neighboring towns. You a little bit yes. after me, of course, you in Wycliffe Lake and me in a town nearby called Hillsdale. And what that turf, which I was when I was growing up there, which I thought of as terribly boring, couldn't wait to leave, you know, get me to New York as soon as possible. What did that turf give you in your creative life?
Well, I felt the same way. It gave me boredom, which gave me dreams. You know, I always, you know, we're obviously diving deep into a lot of like Springsteen culture, but one of the reasons why his work means so much to me is there's a fine line between loving music and hearing yourself and your experience. I mean, when I heard it started with him, he's the architect of it, then it was the local scene and all of the other great music from the shore that I started to discover. You know, first of all, it's the literal landscape. You're hearing streets and places you know, but it's this feeling that there isn't really a word for it. You could say outside the window of the party, you could say younger brother, you could make the medieval comparison calling the Hudson River a moat. But it's deeper. It's, you know, it's our culture. It's we are not there, but we are right there, which is, it's not small town thinking. It's a whole, I mean, let's look at it scientifically. How much energy is coming off of New York City and then dying as it hits New Jersey? I think we grew up in the sort of like metaphorical ash of energy.
All of New Jersey would be thrilled to hear it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, you know, how much beauty does that create? I mean, let's look at New York music, right? Velvet Underground, Strokes, right? Reporting from the center of the world. It's all been there, done that. The first Stroke record when I was younger came out was called Is This It? Question mark. Mm-hmm. You know, let's compare and contrast Is This It with Born to Run. You know, like, I mean, and it's true in my life. The kids I met, I just wanted to be in the city. I wanted to be a New York City band. I wanted to be around it. I grew up knowing every band that was playing in the city that night and not being there.
Not being able to go, yeah.
But it creates darkness and it creates a lot of hope. It creates dreams. There's somewhere to go. It's almost like people who have a very successful father seem to have a tough time. And I feel like growing up in New Jersey, I had nowhere to, and I was lucky, you know, we never worried about food on the table. You could look it up. It's a nice town. We had a nice house. I played t-ball. I went to Jewish school. Like, you know, our worries were not deep, but I never thought that I couldn't outdo my upbringing.
Now, what has done me musically about you over time, and is how much music and musical styles you've incorporated into your work as a musician, as a producer. How does that happen? Did you grow up liking music, country music, for example?
Well, yes and no, because I look back. Well, my dad, interesting story about my dad, is a ragtime musician named Reverend Gary Davis.
Guitar player,
brilliant.
And everybody loved getting lessons from him, all kinds of people.
My dad was one of them.
Yeah.
So I think it was Bergenfield, New Jersey. I think at the time, you could go get a lesson from Reverend Gary Davis, which is crazy.
Unbelievable.
And amazing. So my dad learned in that style, and the style is very specific. It's this sort of fast back and forth picking.
It's really hard.
One sec.
Sure.
It's worth
and Jack,
sorry, I'm just grabbing
and
this
just know
the wall.
If you can do this, I'm always impressed with you. But if you can do this, you're my hero.
It's really hard, but this is like, so I'm gonna play something really poorly that my dad plays great. It's like this kind of style. Okay. So it's that kind of, and that's a.
See, if I could do that, I would die happy immediately.
Yeah. But then yeah. So the level, if you see my dad do it, it's a language. This kind of playing, and it flows through you where your thumb is moving back and forth seamlessly, and you're picking in between. It's got all these blues undertones and just southern undertones, and there's even like this jazz to it. Long story short, I think it opened this idea of me of just like, oh, like there's different kinds of music, because it wasn't just popular music flowing through the house.
You're known not only as a musician and as a writer, but also as an extremely successful and varied producer working with other people. You've done albums with Lana Del Rey, with Lorde. You've done a lot of this since your last album with Bleachers. At what point did producing other artists really take hold for you?
Well, the funny thing about being a producer, and I've only sort of, I realized this when I was getting into it. Like, if you're a songwriter, you can write songs. If you're a performer, you could probably find an open mic night and you might get booed off the stage, but you're a performer. You can't really be a producer unless someone admits that you're a producer. And so I always produced my own records and loved it. But if you do it for yourself, it's a little bit more like, oh, you just kind of make your own records. It's really that lens that someone else sees you through, where they're like, oh, this person can be my producer. And Taylor Swift was the first person who said, we made a song together and I made it sound like everything I wanted it to sound like. And she said, cool, that's that. And that kicked the door wide open.
Jack, one of the collaborations that is really knocked me flat, and it also surprised me when I first heard about it, is you've got a song on the album called 91.
Yeah.
And your collaborator is one Zadie Smith. Tell me
about
that.
That's your world.
So tell me how it came about.
I know Zadie a little bit, and I ran into her near Electric Lady, which is in the West Village. And I'm sure you know Zadie. You know, she's not someone that's like high and by. It's sort of like high, and then 5 minutes later, it's like, and that's why this crushing weight is in tow wherever I go. And what do you think of matcha? You know, it's a sort of, she's a heavy character.
And she can sing, by the way.
She can really sing, and she loves music. So I thought, huh, you know, I work with people who are in music. Zadie's a brilliant writer. I have this song, which I'm having a very, very hard time with. What if Zadie helped me frame it? You just sort of give this unknowing permission where you make space for someone to be like, you know what you could do there? And that was the story with Zadie, and she helped me put it together. She actually sings on a little bit. And the interesting thing about 91 is then I had this mountain with the production. I just could not get that song right. And it ended up being Zadie helping me with the lyrics, St. Vincent coming up with the idea of the strings, and then Warren Ellis, who plays in the Dirty Three and the Bad Seeds, one of my favorite musicians in the world, playing those parts. And it made me feel like this sort of cast of heroes of mine kind of pushing me into the album.
It's 91 horizon, I'm watching black, white, and green. My mother dances around like there ain't no rip in the scene. While she waltzes with ghosts, I can feel what went wrong. Yeah, she's here, but she's not. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm not. Just like her.
Jack, thanks so much. It's really great talking to you.
Great to see you, David.
That's Jack Antonoff, and we spoke last summer before he received the Grammy Award as a producer. I'm David Remnick. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.